So I'll be talking about lithium too, and a bit about lithium rubidium. So Roman suggested I should have shown you a picture of Vancouver and not of our experiment, but I've done this just to just to drive home the point that this is an experimentalist talk. So but before I begin, I just want to thank or acknowledge, I guess, the two PhD students who've taken all the data and done all the work that you'll see today, William Gunton and Mariusz Szymczuk. And we've had some theory support from Xuan Li and Nikesh Dattani. So, and we've gotten some money from various organizations in Canada. So our long-term goal is to create rubidium lithium dimers. And I'll talk a little bit about that, but as I said, today's talk is primarily on lithium too. Which isn't polar, but I'll motivate why we're doing that. So as we all know, polar molecules have incredibly interesting features that aren't available with atoms. And this is a bit like preaching to the choir, so I'm not going to say too much about this. I just want to focus actually on also the dipolar interactions can be very strong, but I want to focus on one of the ingredients that seems critical for some of the proposals. And just to remind you, Dave DeMille sort of was one of the first people to point out that you could realize a quantum logic gate using polar molecules if you had them. And then, of course, there was a very nice review article that described all the wonderful things, all wonderful physics you could do, and wonderful chemistry you could do if you had cool molecules. And Roman, in particular, talked a lot about controlling these chemical reactions. And then in 2006, of course, Michel E. Brennan and Zoller came out with this proposal, which was kind of, in a way, a staggering proposal, because it argued that if you had polar molecules in an optical lattice suitably dressed with microwave fields, you could pretty much do anything from a many-body standpoint, at least from a two-body spin lattice Hamiltonian standpoint. And there have been talks already here in this program on exactly this topic. But very briefly, let me just say that the proposal is, if you have two polar molecules, they interact via some electric dipole-dipole interaction. And if these molecules also have a local spin, and that spin is coupled to this to the inner nuclear axis via some spin orbit or spin rotation coupling, that with the suitable microwave fields, you can drive a transition, a spin flip transition on this molecule, which is sensitive to the state of a neighboring molecule. And this was like a I guess a critical ingredient in this. But once you had that, then they argued that you could sort of realize basically just about any spin lattice Hamiltonian. So this, by spin lattice Hamiltonian, I just mean I have a particle on a lattice site, and it's coupled by some spin-spin interaction with a nearest neighbor. And I think this well, for me, I think this paper kind of, I mean, it was kind of a following in a trend that kind of exploded the possibilities. It sort of showed you if you could make polar molecules, there's some radically interesting things you could do with them. Okay, so as an experimentalist, your job is to make this dream come true.
Is it fair to say there's no alternative for quantum simulation to the polar molecules?
I think there are lots of alternatives for quantum simulation. Mm-hmm. I think trapped ions.
For these particular models.
Oh.
I think the consensus these days is that polar molecules are the best for this kind of simulation.
Mm-hmm. I think.
I mean, I.
Disagrees
with that, they will speak up, but I think that's the consensus in the field. So, the vortex atoms are still going strong?
What?
Vortex atoms and optical atoms are also still going strong. Mm-hmm. Going strong, but they suffer from a lot of problems too. Right?
Right.
That their cold molecules don't suffer from. And, you know, so the only reason why people are still, I mean, people are interested in vortex is because, you know, they're easier to work with. Like, you know, you can you already have ultra-cold atoms, so you just...
They exist already.
Yeah, they exist already, right? So with molecules, you know, it's still going to take a few years to get to the point where you can actually respond. But if you had the choice between molecules and liquid, I think it's fair to say that molecules would be better choice.
So one key point here, of course, is that to do this, you need paramagnetic polar molecules. So you need your cake and the Elita too. You need them to be paramagnetic. And so this is a key point that I'll come back to in a second. And just to drive this point home, so this is a slide I took from Gorshkov's talk on 24th of January, where he talked about topological phases in polar molecules and quantum magnets. And he gave sort of a laundry list of all the proposals that have come out of these ideas. Many of these require polar molecules with a spin degree of freedom as well. Yes?
Correct your turn?
Yes.
Incidentally, this work uses singlet signal molecules.
Yes, but I think many of these proposals require, you're right, so, but many of these proposals that were quoted, this one, for example, and I think this one.
Many of the papers are permanent molecules, yes. But I guess my point is, I wish Alexa was here, but
yes.
My point is that everything that was proposed, in that paper by Michelle, for example, can be done with single molecules that have hyperfine interactions. So you don't really need.
I guess as long as the so you're saying you can realize this effective spin-spin interaction. Okay.
So the strength of the interactions may be a different issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So one could argue that the open shell molecules might have stronger interactions leading to some of the effects.
I see. Okay, so there are alternatives.
Maybe another point, you said in the presence of a microwave field.
Many
of these proposals are
many.
Sort of 50 microwave fields.
Yes.
All fine-tuned, right?
Yes. So, yes.
Especially the singlet sigma stuff. Maybe it's easier with paramagnetic molecules.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen whether or not it's experimentally easier. Yeah. So, so at least that motivated that polar molecules may be interesting, and in particular paramagnetic polar molecules may be interesting. And just as a reminder, the state of the art, at least for polar molecules made from cold atoms, is kind of summarized here. So Bill, of course, proposed that you could very efficiently convert Feshbach molecules into ground state molecules with a particular scheme. And this was done in Debbie Janich and Yi's group in 2008. And they made KRB ground state molecules and then have since been studied some very interesting physics looking at dipolar collisions, and now they have these molecules loaded into a 3D optical lattice. So this is tremendous progress, but I just want to come back to the point before and talk about, I guess, some of the limitations of KRB and why other systems might be, why people might be pursuing other systems. One of the limitations, of course, is that KRB is chemically reactive. Now, this may or may not be a limitation, which is a showstopper, but this point has driven people to look at other alkali mixtures that are chemically stable, so sodium, potassium, sodium rubidium, sodium cesium, so on. These are all energetically stable. The molecule we're playing with is not. But this is, I guess, driven interest in other alkaline mixtures. And another point is that, of course, KRB has zero spin. So it has zero, its ground state is a singlet, and so it has zero electronic spin. And so this has driven people to think about making paramagnetic molecules from, say, you know, mixtures of alkaline earth plus an alkali or a rare earth, as in ytterbium lithium. And quite a bit of effort has gone into realizing these other systems, again, for various reasons, one of them being that people would like to make paramagnetic polar molecules. But I want you to consider the following question, and that is, what about the triplet state, right, of the bioalkali mixtures? So Okay, so as a concrete example, so here's the singlet potential for lithium rubidium, and here's the triplet. So I'm talking about this bound state up here. It's the ground state of this potential. What about that state? Well, that state's definitely paramagnetic. It has a spin of one. You might imagine being able to utilize sort of magnetically tunable chemical reactions or Feshbach resonances. So it's paramagnetic. It's somewhat polar. In fact, the triplet state of lithium rubidium is supposedly around a half a debye, and that's about the same size as KRB. So it's not a huge dipole moment, but it's sizable. And is this useful? Would this be interesting? Well, I guess the real question is it stable? Now, again, maybe this is not a showstopper, because if you segregate the particles, the molecules at a lattice, maybe it doesn't matter if it's stable. But still, it's a good question to ask. And so what are the types of relaxation mechanisms that you can imagine? Well, one of them might be what I'm calling spin relaxation, which just means that this state is somehow coupled to the singlet, and I can, a collision of these two molecules can through some singlet triplet coupling can drive me into this singlet state, which has a lot of bound states lower in energy. But I could also ask a question about chemical reactivity. So is it chemically stable? And here, this is one of the take-home points of this talk. By some magic, is it stable? Or some suitably physical reasons.
So what about like simple magnetic dipole transition rate? I mean, electric dipole is forbidden, but magnetic dipole is allowed, right?
So the emission,
right?
Sure, so the emission of a photon, yeah.
Right, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that lifetime is very long. Mm-hmm.
It's like minutes.
We're
longer.
Yeah.
Hours. Days.
Well, I mean, it is nominally suppressed by alpha squared, right? So Houston atoms. So if in atoms it is, I mean, the usual radiative lifetime, E1, is nanoseconds, so this will be, nanosecond 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 5 seconds. So it will leave not days or at least, at least from this atomic perspective, it's going to leave microseconds, basically, right?
No, but these molecules, they will stay very long. They're stable. It can happen in gas.
Well, and also the new cube helps a lot because the emission with the large distance where the splitter is small.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. So there are also ground state molecules that take plus sigmas, like SO, for instance, which doesn't have hyperfine structure, but it would be hard to cool it to ultra cold temperatures.
Yeah, for the purpose of this talk, I guess I'm just assuming, well, anyway, the motivation is, should people who are doing laser cooling think about these
things? There's a perfect smelly molecule that is the triplet sigma in the ground state.
Yes.
And it's quite holy. This 1.5 debye of an electric dipole moment has just looked up in one of our old papers about this.
So, to address this question, actually, I had a conversation with Roman after digging up one of his old papers, and in particular, we were talking about, is this molecule stable? And well, so what did he say? He said, well, spin orbit couplings are small in light systems, and for lithium dimers, one wouldn't expect a fast relaxation, but it might be more important in heavier systems. But the question is, how important? So yeah, it may be unstable, but maybe not. I don't know. I guess I have no idea how I would even estimate this. But so as an experimentalist, I guess I'm inclined to try to measure it. Then regarding chemical reactivity, Roman had a figure in a paper that he published in 2008 where he was considering the energy surface of a chemical reaction between a 2s atom and a 2s molecule. So here's the atom, here's the molecule. And he said these molecules, if the atom and the molecule are in a triplet state, The interactions are characterized by strong repulsive exchange forces, leading to a significant reaction barrier. So in his paper, he sort of alluded to the fact that if they were in a fully stretched state, that there might be a suppression, an energetic barrier for a reaction, which would mean that even if the product state was lower in energy than the input state, the reaction may not actually go. So this is the singlet surface for the singlet, the chemical reaction for the singlet state, and this would be for the triplet. So so there's reason to believe that, you know, there might be some barrier to a reaction. And of course, if you read the fine print, Roman goes on to say that, well, non-adiabatic coupling may be induced by spin-rotation interaction and the magnetic dipole-dipole interactions. The magnetic dipole-dipole interactions, he argues, are very small. And these spin-rotation interactions, he argues, you could control them with an external electric field. So anyway, so at the moment, at least from my point of view, there are reasons to believe that it might be stable. And if it were stable, it might actually be very interesting to make them. Again, these issues of stability may be irrelevant, I guess, if you segregate the molecules. But if you would like to mix them, stability is key.
It is rather simple, but do you also mean the second order?
Yeah, that's
what you mean. Because that is indeed a short range, you can be very strong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are some selection rules that prohibit the strong spinoric coupling. I mean, we've actually looked at it. It's very small because the energy gap between excited states is small. It's large.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you would expect it to be small?
Yeah. But in addition to that, like I said, you know, we've been looking into this problem, and the problem is that there are selection rules that actually prohibit most of the spin orbit couplings. There are some, and so I think the leading couplings that will lead to the spin relaxation in the first question are the ones that are actually the Coriolis couplings. The ones that are induced by the matrix elements of the electronic orbital angle movement. And those ones are not very significant. Those ones are quite they're square root of two or something.
Okay, so you basically say that due to selection rules in this small quarter, that's why having your special standard cesium, this is like the dominant decay, you know?
Well, cesium is a common nuclear molecule. There is an additional set of selection rules there, because if you look at this, the triplet and singlet potentials, there are G and U symmetry, right? And that, so this inorbit coupling is actually not going to come from that, like even the second order spin orbit. It's but the Coriolis couplings, right? And in heteronuclears it's a little different, but we're still in the middle of, looking for this, but yeah, it's certainly an interesting problem.
But the hyperfine states can couple with U and G, and they can be very nearly degenerate. The couples within the triplet state,
right.
But then in combination with the hyperfine interaction, right. It just relaxes.
Right.
Right. So one would expect in the harmonies there's big changes in lifetime with vibrational load.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a very interesting questions for you to explore.
Yes. Well, this is, I guess, provides a lot of motivation for the triplet state, and I think, and that's sort of what I'm talking about today. And in particular, I'm going to show you some results on, so there are two systems that we're playing with right now, lithium-2 and lithium-rubidium, and we've made the most progress on lithium-2, primarily because we sort of see this as a stepping stone to doing lithium-rubidium molecules. So I'll talk a little bit about the Feshbach resonances that we've measured for rubidium-lithium, and then also the spectroscopy that we've done. And we're very close to, I think we're very close to doing this experiment where we actually produce our triplet ground state molecules from Feshbach resonance molecules. So we have a boson and condensate of lithium dimers, Feshbach molecules, and we're sort of, I don't know, maybe it depends on how optimistic I am, but maybe a month or 2 months away from actually trying to make ground state molecules from our Feshbach resonance molecules.
I'm sorry, these are fermionic atoms?
These are, yeah, it's lithium 6, that's correct, yeah, lithium 6.
And they did rubidium to see those.
Yes, yes, lithium 6.
Both
and. Yes, but that's right. That's right. The rubidium is a boson, and we're trapping the fermionic isotope of lithium. So this will be a fermionic molecule.
Which rubidium isotope?
We trap 87 or 85. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but these are definitely bosonic. Yeah, bosonic molecules made from lithium 6. So this is another slide that I stole from another talk given earlier. Here at KITP. So Timon talked about what's known, what are the molecular properties and potentials that are known, and so there's a lot of open space. Well, I guess here he's written lithium, rubidium, the Feshbach resonances have been measured, and the A state is sort of known, and the A state is the triplet, the bound, the lowest triplet state. And in the case of lithium, the Feshbach resonances have been measured, but I guess the triplet state is not super well known. And that's, anyway, our contributions are in blue, so I'll be talking about measurements of the A state, and I guess this should be done here. We also measure Feshbach resonances, and eventually we would like to measure very accurately this A state for lithium or rubidium. So this is just a brief photographic tour of our experiment. So this is our vacuum chamber, and a peculiarity of our system is that we have a lithium oven. So we have an oven very close to our mott. We don't have a Zeeman solar, so it makes the system rather simple, and it turns out it works just fine. This is the same image, but with a few optics in place, and this is how it looked about a year ago, and now it's even more kind of overgrown with optics. This is a picture of the Mott cell, and here's the oven, and then these are our Feshbach coils, and this is a close-up now of the cell, and then here's the Feshbach coils, and we have these electric field plates, which we're eventually going to use to apply electric fields, and this is just a picture of our lithium Mott in that cell. And what we do, so let me just briefly describe our measurements of the Feshbach resonances. So here's our here are the atoms, and we send in two Faraday tuned red laser beams, which provide an optical dipole trap for the atoms, and then we image along some axis which is almost collinear with this crossed optical dipole trap.
What's the wavelength?
We use kind of a combination of, we have a 1064 nanometer beam, and we also have a 1075. We actually grab them in one optical dipole trap and then transfer them into another one, which is we have a broadband kind of noisy, very high power laser, and then we have a very quiet, low power laser that we transfer them into. So schematically, we load a lithium mott. This is for lithium rubidium mixtures. We then turn on this optical dipole trap. The lithium mott is sort of some fraction of them is transferred into this trap, and then we load a rubidium mott, and then we transfer that in, and the lithium has a trap depth which is about half that for rubidium, and so when we do evaporative cooling, we turn the potential down. Basically, when lithium and rubidium are well equilibrated, the lithium leaves as a sacrificial coolant. It leaves first, and if the rubidium and lithium are decoupled, then the lithium leaves rather slowly as we lower the potential. And so we just look at the atom number as a function of the final power. So this is just a picture of our lithium atoms, and we see. Positions in the magnetic field where the lithium is lost, and this represents points where the rubidium and lithium are well equilibrated. So there's large collisions, a large collision rate. And anyway, we published these results in 2010, and I think of note are that these are the broadest resonances known for any heteronuclear mixture. We had resonances that were hundreds of Gauss wide. And we think eventually this may be useful for studying Efimov physics, primarily because the mass ratio is so large. And we worked for a time to try to realize the electric field tuning of Fresh Rock resonances. And I can talk about that if you're interested at the end. But we've since focused our attention on photoassociation. So when we do photoassociation, we basically just add a single color, which is collinear with one of these optical dipole trapping beams. And in one color photoassociation, I just have a single frequency that couples an S wave colliding pair of atoms to some excited state in the triplet potential, and then, well, okay, this could be any potential, in fact. And then this, of course, there are two possibilities: either decays to some free atom pair that leaves the trap, or it decays to some bound state. In either case, we see a loss of atoms, and the width of these features is basically limited by or set by the excited state lifetime. So there's a picture of a single color peak. If we now add another frequency, so-called two-color photoassociation, and that frequency is resonant between some bound level here and the level that was previously here, you get a doublet, and the splitting is just related to the intensity of this field at omega 2. And Klaus Zimmermann's group is one of the first to do this experiment in lithium 6. So we basically when you look at the atom loss that was previously induced by field omega 1, because this level gets shifted and split, the loss is reduced. There's a suppression of loss, and so what you see is something like this. So here's where, so I'm plotting as a the frequency difference omega 2 minus omega 1. So when omega 2 is off of resonance, when this energy difference does not equal the energy difference between this continuum state and a bound state, then you see the loss is 50%. That corresponds to being right here on this peak. So omega 1 is tuned on resonance. So I would normally see loss at a level of 50%. But then when omega 2 is tuned to just the right frequency that couples this level to some bound level, then I see a revival of the atoms. And here I see a full revival. And of course, the width of these features is set by the coupling of omega 2, the coupling of the two levels. Okay, so those are the two types of spectra I'm going to show you, one color and two color photoassociation. Okay, so here's just a few more pictures. This is the apparatus where we do our laser cooling, and then back here we have our photoassociation lasers, which are two Ti-Sapphire lasers, which are locked to a frequency comb, and it's a fiber-based frequency comb, and with this we're able to our uncertainty on the frequency differences can be below 10 kilohertz, and the line width of these two lasers is about 100 kilohertz. This was verified by an independent by heterodyne measurement. So for one-color photoassociation, I'm showing here the first nine potentials. I think I hopefully haven't missed any, but this roughly shows here's the energy of our two colliding free atoms, and this arrow here represents this band here represents the frequencies that we can access with our Ti-Sapphire laser, at least, without major modifications to the optic set. And what you can see is that in principle we can photoassociate to the B state, this singlet state here, this A state, the C state. Anyway, so there are a number of potentials that we could access, and I'm going to show you spectra for the C state. So we're photoassociating to the C state, and the reason why we're doing that is because we eventually want to make molecules in this A state potential. And so this state actually has been studied previously in a heat pipe and with Fourier transform spectroscopy, and then later by Randy Hewlett's group, they did some photoassociation of atoms in a MOT, and this is where this is the range over which we studied it. So this energy range, and So to minimize the broadening and systematic effects associated with holding the atoms and also the so the trapping of the atoms, and also the we operated at very, very low trap powers and very low photosensation powers. And to operate at very, very low trap powers, you have to have a very cold sample because your trap depth is proportional to the power. So we operated at maybe 300 nanokelvin. And so we were actually photosensitating a two-component quantum degenerate Fermi gas. And our initial state is the two atoms are in the lowest hyperfine state, the plus one-half and minus one-half states. So the total, if it's an S-wave collision, the total spin is zero. So the total spin being the electronic plus the hyperfine plus the nuclear spin. And of course, this is a linear combination of total electronic spin 0, 1. And so the two relevant states, if you will, are the singlet and triplet. And this is our the relevant initial state for us is the triplet because we're photo-associating to the C state, which is this triplet excited state. And so in summary, we were able to measure seven vibrational levels from V equals 20 to V equals 26 with an absolute accuracy of 600 kilohertz. So it's 2 to the minus 5 inverse centimeters. And for each of the vibrational levels, we also were able to observe the rotational level in prime equal 1 and also in prime equal 0 and in prime equal 2. So the way we did that was we had to change, we had to, we tuned our magnetic field so that we were at a magnetic field where we had P wave collisions between the spin up with itself or the spin down with itself or the spin up with the spin down. Tuning to this P wave Fischbach resonance, we were able to enhance the P wave collision rate so that we were able to photo associate to the n equals 0 and n equals 2 state up here. So, and we also characterized the systematic shifts due to the magnetic field and whatnot. So we made very accurate measurements of these levels. And just to give you a feel for that, you know, the accuracy of these measurements are on the order of tens of gigahertz. And in this work, it was around 20 megahertz. And we were several orders of magnitude better. So this is the fairly accurate, or the most accurate measurements of this state so far. And interestingly enough, we of course naively expected to see a single excited state, but we actually saw three features. What are those three features? Well, those are just so the level that this data shows is the V equals 24 level n equals 1 and the spin is 1. Of course, the spin and the rotation degree freedom can be coupled. So I really need to define the J quantum number, which is the combination of N and S. And there's a spin-spin and spin-rotation coupling that split these. So this state down here is effectively a J1 because the spin is 1 and the N is 0. So I can access, the selection rule is that delta J has to be plus or minus 1 or 0, so I can access J prime equal 1, 2, and 0. And from the splittings, we were able to infer the spin-spin and spin-rotation coupling constants for this excited state. So now let me just tell you about the two-color spectroscopy. So here what we did was we parked the laser on this transition from our continuum to the J equal 1 state, and then we just tuned a second laser at omega 2 to find the bound states of this A potential. Some of the motivations for why we're doing this, one is purely technical. We happen to be able to access this with our lasers. And also 0.6, this is a stepping stone for making lithium rubidium because we're going to use the same laser setup. And it was a lot of, anyway, we spent a lot of time building the frequency comb and getting all the locking working. And it made sense to first try this on a simple system like lithium. Lithium, of course, it's interesting in its own right. It has a magnetic moment. And so, you know, our hope is that we can eventually make a BEC of ground state molecules. We can make a BEC of fresh rock molecules. We just have to transfer them. And then we can play with, you know, maybe we can measure magnetically tunable fresh rock resonances, collisional resonances for these molecules. And of course, we would like to measure this spin blockade. So what is the lifetime of these molecules? And do they decay to the singlet state or not? And another thing that we're very interested in doing is to so people have been for quite some time now studying the alignment of molecules with very high intense laser fields, and there's also been some work on what's called this it's called an optical centrifuge. This was invented by Paul Corcoran, where they spin molecules up to some incredibly high angular minimum J state, and these things are called super rotors, and one possible application of making these ground state molecules is that we could spin them and study their collision properties. We could also spin the Feshbach molecule, as Bratislav has argued. You could learn something interesting about just trying to align or spin the Feshbach molecule itself. And Valerie Milder, who's in the lab like 10 meters to the north of us, has an optical centrifuge, and we have money to do these experiments. So this is another reason that we're interested in making lithium two. You could also spend lithium rubidium, but lithium two is easier to make.
How is this going to be different from starting from room temperature
molecules? I guess you can study, low energy collisions if you have an ultra cold sample. So it's, I think, to my knowledge, there haven't been a lot of, I shouldn't make this statement because I don't know for sure, but I don't think there's been a lot of work done on the collisional properties of these super rotors, so far as I know.
Also, it will be in coherent states, right? You'll have a coherent rotational state, unlike room temperature when you're always in the thermal.
No, but I was thinking about, using the optical centrifuge to spin room temperature molecules to, because
you can do that,
them to, J equals 100.
Yes.
And, so you could do it at room temperature, right? And then, there's a couple of people who do that, so Hammond
I guess the issue is, you would like to then study how these molecules collide, and knowing their initial state and their final state is sort of important in that, presumably.
So collide molecules that are in the state that J equals 100, and the translational energy, molecules.
Yes, that's the idea. Yeah. Or in this case, maybe 100 nanokelvin or so. So in this two-color photoassociation, my initial state is this S equal 1, J equal 1 state, and the intermediate state is this triplet state, S equal 1, and I can either go to the J equal 1 or the J equal 2 or the J equal 0. So I'm going to show you some data where we went to the J equal 1, and then we tuned omega 2 to couple that state to some bound state down here in the A. In this lower triplet state, and so this shows the revival of the atoms. So here's loss and here's no loss when this frequency difference matches basically the binding energy of one of these levels here, and this is for the V equal 1 and N equals 0 state. And of course we see here three features, and more or less all of whatever level we go to, equal 2 or 0 or 8 or 9, we always see three features, roughly speaking, and the question is, what are these features? And of course the final state, the state down here, it's in the triplet state, and I'm telling you that the rotational quantum number is 0, and so that means J is 1, but there's only one value of J, it's just 1. and so we think that this structure that we're seeing is just hyperfine structure. The spin is 1, so we do expect to see three different levels, and we believe this is hyperfine structure. So this is still, this week is like, this data is like a week old. So this is our conjecture. And if I can, just for the fun of it, I can label these peaks F1, F2, and F3, and then I can plot the energy difference as a function of V, and I see this. So here's, this is V equals 9, V equals 8, V equals 7. These more or less each have three peaks, except for V equals 9 only has two here. So this is the the frequency difference F3 minus F2. So that's this separation here, this small separation, and the other separation is F2 minus F3. Yes?
Can I ask you a question? Uh-huh. Are you seeing three peaks because you want to see three peaks?
I don't know. Let's say most of these spectra, one of them had four peaks. So and this one is a bit messy because one of the lasers got unlocked, but yes, they're quite messy, but they seem to show, at least this one, and this one seem to show pretty clearly three peaks, but some of them, sometimes this main peak is broad, and God knows there may be some structure there.
So if this was hyperfine structure, it wouldn't change dramatically with the vibrational quantum.
Yes, and it doesn't seem to be changing dramatically, although there is some change. I mean, this is 80 megahertz, and this is 100 megahertz, so this is 20%. So, you know, is this an error bar because of not in a control systematic, or I don't know what? This is 150 megahertz. This is 130. So this is 20 out of 100. This is about 20% variation. And this is actually this. So this is even more. This is the same data. I'm just now showing you for variational levels 3, 2, 1, and 0. And there seems to be something odd going on. So we're not entirely sure. We were expecting it not to vary with B, but it varies a little bit. We can come back to this.
Doesn't it have to be interaction with the X thing?
Which could vary with the vibration.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So variation because of near degeneracy between triplet levels and single levels. Mm-hmm. That's my guess. Mm-hmm.
So with the hyperfine track.
Yeah. The hyperfine is the only thing that breaks your G. Mm-hmm.
But is that going to be a...
Do you know the lithium-2-6 dimer cells? You do, from Randy Gary's work and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where they are?
You mean the X state?
The X state compared to the A state.
So I'm not sure.
I mean, we know them in RB2. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Both of the states and KRB is another case where again you know both, but there's no UG in KRB.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I don't know how well the X state is known. I think
it's known pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was what you call two photon photo association done in the U.S.
Randy did it. Mm-hmm.
Where they saw those high levels.
They all have been looking at the
pattern.
Yeah, but. How far detuned is this?
This is 300 wave numbers.
300 wave numbers.
Yeah, so it's likely that.
Well, that's
yeah.
probably known from conventional spectroscopy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but not at the kind
not
of
J equals zero.
Yeah, yeah.
But in order for this UG complex to be important, you need to have degeneracies, right? Because
right.
If they're not degeneracies.
So I think that's what William is saying, or Bill is saying, is that there may be some levels that are nearby that are perturbing.
I don't know. They have to be close.
Mm-hmm. So we can come back to this. Let me just show you the. We also looked at not only the n equals zero, but also the n equals two state. So we can, of course, come down here to the n equals zero state. But there's also we can also access the n equals two state. So the rotationally excited state. And now. Because n equals 2, j can be either 1 or 2. And so at first we thought, if we saw three features before, maybe we should see six features. And we don't quite see six. We see five, roughly speaking. But there's definitely some structure there that looks suggestive. And so then what we did was we figured, one of these is probably the j equal 1 and one is the j equal 2. So then what we did is the following experiment. So this is just showing the same data. Reminding you that I'm going up to a J equal 1 and then down to the n equals 2 state, and that gives us this black curve. And now if I do the same experiment, but now I I go up to the J equals zero state, the J equals zero can only be coupled to, well, the selection rule is a delta J has to be plus or minus one or zero, and so there's a one and a two here, and there's also a three, the one, two, and three here. So this level here is only coupled to the J equals one, and so what you see is these peaks here went away for the red data, and these peaks here remained for the what?
Sort of.
There's a on the scale the signal to noise is anyway there's a bit of noise there, but if I were to, but roughly speaking, I think from this we concluded that these three features here, these must be associated with the J equals one, and these two here must be associated with the J equals two state. That was kind of our conclusion from that. And then presumably, these features here are just hyperfine splitting of this level, and this feature here is just hyperfine splitting of that level. That was kind of this data was taken last night. So I guess the question here was, where's the third feature? But there's some noise there, and maybe we just have to look more carefully. But now, if I just for fun, I'm gonna label these levels F1, F2, F3, F4, and F5. So these are the frequencies, and I'm now gonna plot the difference of these frequencies. So F5 minus, actually, I'm gonna plot them all with respect to F1. So F2 minus F1 and F3 minus F1 and so on, F4 minus F1 and F5 minus F1 as a function of the vibrational quantum number. And so, so you see, these are all. The red one is 3 minus 1, and this is 4 minus 1, and this is 5 minus 1. So these states here obviously are moving away from the. So this level here, this is 2 minus 1, and 1 minus 1 is just a line down here at 0. So this curve here and the axis basically are associated with the J equals 2 state, and these are all the states associated with the J equals 1 state. And so they're moving away from they're moving away from this J equals 2 state as we go down in the vibrational ladder, which I guess makes sense. You'd expect there to be different spin-spin and spin-rotation coupling constants that vary with V. But the hyperfine splitting, that is to say the difference between, say, this level and zero, it's not changing much with the vibrational level. So this is still somewhat preliminary, but at least it's suggestive that these are in fact all associated with the J equals 1 state, and this level here and the F1 level are associated with the J equals 2 state in the ground state. So that's all I want.
Is peak 1 broader significantly than the other peaks?
The width of this peak here.
I guess the last 5 is comparably broad.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, it would be hard to say at this point. We can take much higher resolution scans. We just didn't because we just wanted to find the levels. But I guess that would be the next step to see. Definitely there was a, if I go back to the n equals zero data, there was a significant difference in width. So if you can see here, this is for the n equals zero data, and this peak here was almost always much broader than these residual peaks. That's a good question. I don't yet have a conjecture on why that is. I guess I was hoping that the experts in the audience might have an idea. But maybe we can come back to this. I just want to maybe conclude in the interest of finishing on time. In conclusion, I guess I would like to, I guess the take-home message here is that we've fully characterized the triplet ground state. We've measured all 10 vibrational levels. For each vibrational level, we found both rotational levels, or two rotational levels. in prime, in double prime is zero, or in double prime is two. And we've also measured, at least resolved, splitting, which we associate with, it must be associated with the spin-spin and spin rotation coupling, and also the hyperfine structure. And the bound state energy resolution, although the data I was showing aren't particularly high resolution, in principle we can retake those data and nail down the bound state energies to, with respect to the continuum, with a resolution better than half a megahertz. I mean, we could even go to 100 kilohertz. It just, at that point, we just have to control our magnetic, external magnetic fields and whatnot. So this is, I think this is unprecedented, and I think this is probably the most accurately known molecular potential there is at this point. Now, is that useful? I don't know. This happens to be the simplest molecule after H2, and so maybe that's useful. Maybe that's exciting and important. But we're definitely very excited about this. And the next step, of course, is to try to make these molecules, transfer our Feshbach resonance molecules into these levels and look at lifetimes, and maybe try to answer, at least preliminarily, answer some questions about the stability of the triplet. And it would be a homonuclear triplet, but I think maybe a reasonable and worthwhile first step. So that's where we're going, and thank you for your attention. Yes?
Does the energy of the last bound level correspond to the scattering lengths for 6
LI? Oh, excellent question. So we measured, yes. So we measured the position of this level, and it's in somewhat good agreement with measurements that Randy Hewlett did. So Randy Hewlett has measured this not vehicle 9 level for the triplet and the vehicle 38, the least bound state of the singlet, and our results are in fairly good agreement. Although there's some slight disagreement, and I think it's within a few sigma of his error bar, so it might be that it's very much the same. The triplet scattering length hasn't changed dramatically as a result of these measurements, but we at least have a much more precise handle on it. The next step would be to measure the singlet, the least bound state of the singlet, which we can also do, and then we could probably know the scattering lengths with even better precision. I think Randy's measurements were, again, on the order of tens of megahertz precision, or maybe, because he was using it. Anyway, so, and I think we could probably improve that measurement by at least an order of magnitude, if not two. Is it important to know the scattering length so well? I'm not so sure, but maybe Robert can tell us.
What is the energy of this least bound level?
Pardon me?
What is the energy of this least bound level?
It's 24 gigahertz. It's about almost a wave number, not quite. That's the binding energy, the n equals 0. The n equals 2 is about 16 gigahertz, so half a wave number. And the triplet, the singlet is going to be even less bound, I guess, because the binding of this state is so deep that there's a virtual bound state that is trying to be born, and that's why the scattering length is humongous in lithium. It's
are you thinking with retardation effects?
So let me make it clear. Is it vehicle 9, you said, is 24 gigahertz?
That's correct. Vehicles 9, n equals 0, is 24 gigahertz. The vehicles 9, n equals 2, is 16 gigahertz below the continuum. So,
is there a rotational state that can support the vehicle 9 vibrational state?
We found the n equals 2, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Next pleasure.
So you use your long range.
Right, exactly.
Can I back to that question of the line widths.
Sure.
So these were hyperfine triplets.
Uh-huh.
You wouldn't expect them to be different widths, right? Why? I mean, what determines the line widths?
So you might imagine that if we had some shot-to-shot fluctuation of the magnetic fields that might move lines around and broaden them.
These states are also different in their degeneracy.
Right.
Yes. That means that, for instance, the broadest peak, I might have more degenerate components, and therefore, it will be easier to access.
In the zero field, you may get a big slope, therefore, the magnetic field is generated.
Yeah, I guess we expect one to be F equal 2, 1, and 0. So.
I mean, do you have the Zeeman patterns for the hyperfine structure yet?
We haven't done that, yes. Yeah, that's kind of the next, though that day will take tomorrow, I guess.
Well, there's theory also.
Yes.
There's a no relationship between the rotational degrees of freedom and the hyperfine component, because you have 0, 1, and 2,
mm-hmm.
right? And our selection rules that's not correct. Or at least, shift the hyperfine state to a different position.
So you're asking, is there a nuclear spin molecular rotation coupling?
There must be very small compared to the normal spin.
I mean, we definitely do see. So, for example, if I look at these three features here, this is for the Jekyll 1, n equals 2. I could compare the splitting of these levels with respect to that state, and the n equals 0 splitting. Let me show you the exactly. So in fact, here you can see it. So. So let's see this. We can just look here. There are different, but so for v equals 8, there are two levels. So I have f2 minus f1 and f3 minus f2. Just to remind everyone, I was labeling f3 as this big one. Okay, so 2 minus 3. This is this closed spacing and. And 1 minus 2 is this far spacing. So if I look here, the small spacing, that is to say the distance from this peak here to that peak there, is about 75 megahertz. And the splitting between the 1 and the 2, that is to say from this peak here to that peak there, is about 145. So it's about double. So this splitting here is about twice that splitting. And if I look here, I'm now interested in the, this is gonna be hard to see, isn't it? Because I haven't plotted it this way, but in any event, I guess we can just look at it. This is, this spacing from here to here is about 100 megahertz. This is 100 megahertz. And so this spacing from this peak to that peak is about 100 megahertz. Sorry, it's about 50. From here to here is about 50, and from here to here is about 50. So roughly speaking, the splittings appear equal.
Yes, so for n equal to 0, your f is 4, peak is not there, right?
Say again? If
so n equal to 0, what you call it f4, that one is not there, right?
Yes.
There's three peaks.
Yes, three peaks.
If I add equal to 0,
so
there's only two peaks.
No, there are three.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, it's this one, this one, and this
one.
So these three here correspond, if you believe it, these are hyperfine split, and the splitting is.
Okay. Yeah, I thought they were on the same scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not, unfortunately. Yeah. And this, yeah, this is also a Jekyll one. So these are both, this is the Jekyll one, and this is the Jekyll one. And all I've changed here is I've gone from n zero to n equal two. So so there is, obviously there's a difference, and it appears that this splitting is quite a bit larger than it is down here. In fact, so beyond that, I don't know what else to say, but.
Do you have the V double prime equal 9 and double prime equal 2?
Yes.
Is there any additional problem?
Let's see. So you want the.
You're saying it's still bound, but you're saying it's not above the dissociation.
That's correct, yeah. So here's the. Yeah, well, this is very preliminary data. It's hard to really tell. But yeah, this is the n prime equal 2. In fact, you can see that, I mean, a lot of these levels are kind of buried in noise. But we previously took the data at much larger powers. We had to turn down the power quite a bit to actually resolve these states. We were seeing even some really weird, what almost look like EIT resonances that were showing up whenever we were broadening, when our pump and dump fields were too strong. We actually saw some what appears to be very sharp dips in the photodissociation, and show like there's some pretty dramatic things like this, for example. So this is a recovery of the atom number when I'm on resonance, and these features broadened out so much that I would see these very, very sharp, what looked like sort of EIT dips in this resonance signal. So this is at low power, and this is at higher power. So yes?
My question is from the rubidium lithium
Okay.
At some point you mentioned the time patron that you can reach. Mm-hmm. 0.4 TF, I think. Can you say more probably the information for the cooling and observing quantum degeneracy?
Specifically for mixtures of lithium rubidium.
Yes.
Yeah, so we haven't we haven't pushed hard to see how far we can cool, but one of the limitations that we have right now is that we cool rubidium at the expense of lithium. So we sort of throw away, just because our traps, we could change this presumably, but right now we're limited. So when we cool lithium by itself, we're able to reach, yes, temperatures of, even we've reached T over TF of 0.2. The data I showed were at 0.4. When we add rubidium to it, to the mix, it provides a heat load, and so we're not able to cool as deeply into the degeneracy regime, and so far I think we've come close. We've cooled. Again, we haven't really tried hard at this, but we were able to cool to about 2 over TF of about maybe 0.6 for lithium, and right at the condensation temperature for rubidium 85. We weren't operating at the Feshbach resonance where the scattering length is positive, so we're at some other magnetic field which is suitable for rubidium lithium collisions. So we haven't really gotten to the point where we have both degenerate. I mean, one is sort of degenerate, the other one is kind of partially. We're just above TC. But we're presently making some upgrades to the machine, so I suspect we'll be able to reach degeneracy soon. And that's required, I guess, if we want to make our Feshbach molecules in lithium rubidium. The efficiency will be limited by how cold we can get. So in the case of lithium, yeah, it's God's gift to the atom community, because it, as you know, has this incredible property that you can evaporate at the Feshbach resonance and have no losses and convert all your... Anyway, it's really a wonderfully easy system to use from an experimentalist standpoint. So you don't have to segregate the particles in the lattice. But what do you have in mind? What would you be interested in a person looking for? if they had. You were just.
Of course, if you go to explore quantum physics or on many body point of view and the role of quantum physics.
This is definitely on our long-term to-do list, but at the moment, I guess we're we're at our bandwidth limit for our manpower, just doing these spectroscopy experiments. But that's one of the things that I mentioned that didn't have time to talk about was we actually tried to look for electric field tuned Feshbach resonances. So because you have this molecule, these two atoms colliding, and the underlying molecular state that's driving Feshbach resonances is itself polar, if you apply an electric field, Roman argued some years ago that you could tune the position of the Feshbach resonances. And so this is something that we started to try to do, but...
Well, these experiments are without electric field.
That's correct. Yes, yeah.
One interesting thing of the Ready 85 is you can tune the scattering length to zero.
Yes.
Have you done that with the lithium?
We haven't. No, we haven't.
So rubidium collisions should end.
Mm-hmm. And then it's only lithium colliding with rubidium. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And lithium with lithium.
Yes, yes. Yes. Well, there are reasons, and Brett maybe can comment on this. There are reasons to look for interesting many three body and maybe four body physics and lithium. Yes. And so definitely being able to tune the scattering lengths at will is important. And so that's another thing that's kind of on our to do list, but we just haven't. We just haven't found the time to do it, but to try to look for these mass imbalanced Efimov physics. So.
You mentioned RBH in your abstract.
Oh yes, yeah. So yes, yeah, so there's the idea. Maybe it's hard to see here, but Takamasa Mimosa is also at UBC. 50 meters from our lab, and he's actually to the north also, yes, yes. They've built so they're working on slowing cold molecules and cold atoms from supersonic expansions. They have a coil gun slower and a magnetic slower, also a Stark decelerator, and so we. Put together this apparatus where they have an atomic hydrogen source, which is then slowed and turned in a quadrupole magnetic guide, and then focused down to a rubidium mott. So here's a picture of our rubidium mott, and the idea basically is to to slam these hydrogen atoms into the rubidium atoms and eventually photo-associate them. And this is kind of relying on the fact that the triplet state only has maybe one bound level. And so if you go up the ground triplet state, and so if you go up to the excited triplet state and you decay, there are certain levels that have a fairly high branching ratio to the ground state. You can form triplet molecules with a fairly high efficiency. You just need a boatload of hydrogen so you get enough collisions. One of the challenges here is that, because rubidium is so heavy, of course, the hydrogen that comes in, it's like a ping pong ball hitting a beach ball. You know, if it sticks, the center of mass energy of that molecule is 1/100th of the center of mass energy of the incident hydrogen beam. So, but I guess one of the challenges is we without slowing. Like if we just shoot a 500 meters per second hydrogen beam in there, we're going to have collisions of all partial waves, or many, many partial waves. And the one we're interested in is the, n equal 0, or maybe n equal 2. And so it remains to be seen how slow do we have to slow them in order to have high enough rate of low partial wave collisions to photo-associate. But this is, the machine at least is kind of was born just recently, and we're working on.
How deep is the ground state? And there's only one ground state, right?
Yes, yes.
Kind of normal, or is it?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, you asked me this before, and I think it's I have no earthly idea, but I suspect it's probably on the order of a wave number, if not quite, maybe a fraction of a wave number, maybe a tenth, maybe a hundredth, the rubidium, of course, is essentially stationary. In fact, what our plan is to take the rubidium cloud and to launch it in the direction of the oncoming hydrogen beam, so that in the center of mass the center of mass frame would be in the lab frame basically. So then the temperature of the molecules you would generate is just related to the dispersion of velocities in the hydrogen beam, and that can be fairly small. It can be on the order of a Kelvin or less. And that means the molecules you form are a hundredth of that temperature. They're tens of millikelvin. And if we believe in the magic that Roman is selling, those molecules, once you form them, we can magnetically trap them, and we can mix them with rubidium, and then sympathetically cool them with rubidium. So that's the that's sort of the pipe dream at this point, and I think it's certainly worth trying. So that's kind of the motivation for.
So I mean, I think an interesting extension would be to try to make triplet RV2 in your mock, as we've done in our mock, and mainly in vehicle zero as the dominant, and that involves a photo association through the first triplet Leydig state. But I haven't collided it with hydrogen atoms. I don't have a hydrogen beam to do that with. So if you have triplet molecules in there,
it'd be very interesting.
A doublet atom could collide and make RVH.
So that would be very interesting.
And this is a continuous experiment. It's not a pulse, is it?
That's correct, but we would probably. Well, okay, the hydrogen beam is pulsed, and only because the slower, this it's a bunch of coils, it's a magnetic slower. These coils are pulsed on for maybe a millisecond at a few thousand amps, and so they have to be turned off and left to rest for a few seconds before they can be turned on again. I think the rep rate is about a second, yeah, so I think that's the limit on the rep rate. But our hope is to get high enough flux that essentially in a single shot we have every rubidium atom in basically colliding with at least one hydrogen atom. I mean the sample is so dilute that only one out of a million hydrogen atoms actually encounters a rubidium atom. So it's quite a large flux that we're talking about, but that's the goal, is to basically have a high enough flux on a single shot that every single rubidium atom encounters a hydrogen atom. And the photon flux, done a back of the envelope calculation, we should be able to provide enough photon flux to photo-associate every single one of those collisions, even though there's a distribution of energies there. So, again, the bottleneck, I think, will be what fraction of those collisions are in the n equals 0 or n equals 2 partial wave, because we want to photo-associate to, a low-lying rotational state and then have that decay to the bound state, which is, and I don't know how many rotational levels are supported in the least, in that triplet potential. But that's
Robbie Tote has studied the triplet in lithium ion.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
It has very good numbers for bound by water.
For the triplet alkaline hydride potentials that are available, there are no rotational excited states.
Okay, so there you go.
There's only one probe vibrational state.
How good do you think those potentials are, Brad?
Well, I think apart from lithium lithium hydride, the consensus is that there is a bound state. The lithium hydride is not bound. I think there is some data suggested that there is a ground state. So,
certainly for the deuterium, it's not.
Right.
For the deuterium.
That's true. Yes. That's true.
Well, 15 minutes before the cookies.
I was thinking about the possibility of deep leaping and deep to 9 state and all the two experiments. Breathing it by shining the ensemble with an off-resonant laser beam, either in the CW or pulsed regime, whatever, and look at the depletion as a function of the intensity of this optical field.
So by depletion, you mean you're spinning it and it breaks apart?
Exactly. You deplete it by imparting enough angular momentum for the molecule to dissociate. Uh-huh. It should not be too much. That it would not require too much momentum. Mm-hmm. Question is how much intensity would be needed, and it would depend on the anisotropy of the polarities of the liquid, mm-hmm. the two species in the A state. Any idea what this polarization would be?
So Valerie actually looked into this, and I haven't talked with him, but his basic answer was we have enough juice. That was so.
That's what I would guess.
Yes. Yeah. One of the issues with doing those experiments is that obviously we would like to off-resonantly excite it, rotate it with this off-resonant beam without resonantly exciting it. And so so that's one issue. In order to do that, we might have to notch out frequencies from the short pulse laser to not resonantly excited. And so I guess part of the, I would say the next step to realizing those that work would be to actually map the levels within the bandwidth of our femtosecond pulse. And in principle, I guess we could do that with the with the femtosecond pulse. But we have to get rid of those resonant excitations first. But that's definitely something we would like to try, and I think we're at this point it's really a matter of bandwidth limit. I just don't have enough.
Great. This may seem really this species is a state of lithium to have the best known potential if you succeed.
It may help. Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I'm very excited about that. But as I said, it's hard to know what to do next, we just need more hands in the lab. So,
is anybody trying to?
Kennedy would like a postdoc.
Analyze your data to get a good potential, something like TMOD or something.
So far, I guess the only people who have seen it now, other than you guys, is are Schwan and Nikkei Dattani, and I think. So I don't know to what degree they have the wherewithal to do this analysis, but yeah, I guess the next step would be to find someone who could help us with that. And I think another key element in all this is to understand the Zeeman structure of both the excited state and the ground state, because we really want to convert our Feshbach molecules, and these things are born at 800 Gauss. And it's going to be better if we can do all that photodissociation at a very high magnetic field and not have to turn down to zero, because there are all sorts of other issues. The Feshbach molecules are perfectly happy right near the Feshbach resonance, and they get very unhappy if you turn the magnetic field down. So we really need some help in understanding how the spectrum is going to look. I mean, we can just empirically measure it, but I think having some calculations would be essential. And then the idea would be to convert our molecules and then maybe look for these lifetime measurements to do this lifetime measurements.
What are the fine numbers of the 800 Gauss Feshbach resonance?
Let's see if I have.
It's being called nine, I assume.
It's a funny mixture of the singlet and Triplet. Yeah, it's, do I have a picture? There's, there's this picture in, so this is the, this is the, yeah, this is the singlet, and, actually this, these are two levels in the singlet, I believe. Yeah, this is from, I should have put the reference here.
Yeah, there are actually two federal residences for S-wave. Right?
Yes.
And they are coming from the same bronze state. Mm-hmm. But the difference is indeed that they are different in nucleus.
Yes.
That one turns out to be very narrow. Mm-hmm. The other one turns out to be very wide.
Yes.
And therefore you get this large curvature all the way down to 800.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
It's sort of 500. Mm-hmm. And then if you then go to P-base and you see that the missing one,
yeah, this statement here, yeah, the vehicle 38 bun level singlet crosses near 534 Gauss, this narrow resonance that you just referred to, and the other more strongly one, so on the other hand, the energy of the strongly interacting I equals zero bound state changes dramatically above 540 Gauss and becomes nearly parallel to the energy of the entrance channel. And you said the state switches to an S equal 1 character near the 540 Gauss crossing and transforms into the vehicle's 10 level of the triplet potential at higher magnetic field. So presumably somewhere between here and here, it's sort of triplet-like. But if you were to make the molecule and tune the magnetic field back, you would have something that's more singlet-like. So presumably, photo associated.
From the picture, right? It is like saying it means
yes.
There's no magnetic moment, so therefore it's straight.
Yes.
And the curvature means you have nature.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So one would expect then that, you know, we can photo associate very nicely to the triplet excited state from here, but that, you know, our overlap is going to be very poor if we have to turn down the magnetic field. So
where is the vehicle 10 level then at zero field?
It's not, it doesn't exist, right? It's born.
What's your energy scale?
That's a good question. So I think.
So it's positive energy by some amount. It looks close to zero. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what.
Well, this. Plotted. Yeah, so this vehicle 10 level that they're referring to doesn't exist at zero magnetic field. So how do I see that from this picture? I guess this is
it has to go to zero.
Well, this is the entrance channel. So this is the spin up, spin down combination of the free atoms, and then these are the bound levels here. So
well, you mean that this is a singlet bond state, right? And the triplet potential is indeed just in bond. I'm discussing the angle of minus 2000.
Yes.
Just not there.
Yes, but apparently, it's
the magnetic field is going to go down from zero. Right?
But apparently, it's
up zero.
But this problem between a singlet and triplet, right? I mean, just a pure triplet potential doesn't have to be.
That's right.
Sure, so these are, this is the pure singlet bound state, right?
Well, I think these lines here represent the energy of the singlet bound state, the vehicle 38. The vehicle 10 level, which they refer to in this figure, doesn't exist, at zero of magnetic field, but presumably because of this coupling, is suddenly pops into existence above some magnetic field. Above.
It's a bit of a strange statement.
It is a bit.
You found 9 bound states, right?
Yes. Then we found 10 bound states.
Oh, you found that, but yeah. 9 was the highest.
Yes.
9, 0 to 9.
Yes. Yes.
So that's the 11th bound state.
Yes, that's correct.
I'd just like to know where it is compared to the dissociation line. It's not obvious.
Well, I think this is, I guess maybe this is the, this is what you would call the halo dimer. So the, when you form the Feshbach molecule, right at the resonance, there's a dimer whose energy is given by h bar squared over, you know, a squared or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, the reduced mass. And I think that's the state they're referring to. And that state has, the way I read this is that state has a triplet-like character. I mean, it is a bit odd because it's arising.
It's a bit strange.
It is a bit strange, yeah.
There's no real triplet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. So I'm not really sure, yeah, what does this mean?
Do you have a reference?
Yes, yeah, well, this is this very long review article on Feshbach resonance that's written by
Chang.
Yes,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And others, yeah.
Adjourn in the interest of time, sure. And thank Kurt, maybe.